Thanks very much. Let me first officially open the meeting and welcome members of the Standing Committee Finance. Welcome officials from Treasury, Momo, and your colleagues. Yanga, I hope today the gadget is working. We'll be able to see you. We haven't seen your face since 2020 February. SARS, I'm not sure if the commissioner is here. We were with him yesterday. PBO, Dr. Jankis and your team. SCOF support team. Stakeholders, that's the public. Those who have made submissions and will also be making an input today. Members of the media, the public, you are all welcome. Are there apologies?
Yes, Chair, apologies from Mr. Kwankwa and Hill Lewis.
Okay. Those apologies will be recorded. We don't have much time because many members today will be flying to Cape Town, including myself. So we'll have to try to drive the program to move a bit faster. As tomorrow, the minister will be tabling the MTBBS. So some of us will have to be in the chamber physically. So I will request that we stick to the time allocated so as to cater for those of us who will be driving to various airports. Response by, let's go to item two, response by National Treasury and SARS to the submission received for TLAB, TALAB, and the rates and monetary amounts and amendment of revenue laws, bills, rates, bill. We'll start. Is it Momo? Is it Yanga? Over to you. 40 minutes, please. Hey. Momo, can you unmute?
Oh, sorry. No, apologies, Chair. I was saying I'm actually in Parliament and I was hoping to see the honourable members in the flesh and not as we all are online, you know.
We'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay, over to you, Momo.
Apologies. The technology here is more difficult than in Parliament than at home. We've got a few slides, not a few, quite a few. And Chair, just to remind members, so as you said, it's three bills we're looking at. We're looking at the rates bill, rates and threshold bill. We're looking at the TLAB and the TALAB bills. And as we, as members know, these are bills that have been, are going to give effect to the February budget. And so, Chair, I just want to also say that, you know, these things, it's a coincidence that it's close to MTBBS. So for all just to know, what we're saying today is not any new announcement. It's an announcement as of and reflect comments and so on that we receive comments. The bills themselves were published around the end of July, and today we'll obviously then deal with Chapter 4 and Annexure C of the budget review. The proposals in there. The first round of comments we closed for was And the idea is, after today, taking the comments into account, the minister will be tabling the bills tomorrow, Chair, because just of the time constraint, and to the extent that we'll try and make it may be difficult to make some changes now, but we'll do it through the money bills process after they introduce. And I think that's just important to bear in mind, Chair. Given the period that Parliament was obviously busy during the local government elections, it does leave us very little time, I think, to table bills and so on. Next slide, please. So, Chair, what we do is, as you know, we've circulated a draft document of response. I think these are just the timelines of the presentation we've already made in Parliament, which was, if I remember, around the end of August. We had workshops with stakeholders, those who submitted comments, and today we're ready to present. Myanga, do you want to start taking over? Myanga and Chris are with me, Chair, and Franz Tomasek from SARS and other colleagues, Renel, and I haven't checked who else is here since everyone's online. So these are the bills. Myanga, do you want to start?
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Good morning. Thank you, Mama. Good morning, Chair. Good morning, members of
the panel. Show us that your technology problems are resolved and they can see who you are and you're not a robot.
I think I'm not a robot.
All right, Momo, we have to give up. It looks like we are not going to succeed with this campaign. Okay, over to you.
Thank you, Chair. I also want to add on what Momo has said is that this year there was a separate second batch of the 2021 draft TLAB and 2021 draft TALAB, which was published on 12 August, which contained the emergency tax measures in response to the continuing COVID-19 and recent unrest in the country. These measures were over and above the proposals that were made in the 2021 budget on 24 February. So what we have done is that we have consolidated the two bills. So there is no longer a second batch now of the 2021 draft TLAB and 2021 draft TALAB. So we have consolidated all those into the 2021 draft TLAB. So the second batch is no more because those measures we have included it in this bill. So you're going to see three bills instead of five bills. The responses that we're going to do are the key important issues that were raised in Parliament during the public hearings. But the response document contains all the responses to the comments that we have received, even those that were raised by written comments and during public workshops. But now the slides only contain the key important issues that were raised during Parliament and some of the input and some of the other issues, maybe one or two that were raised outside the parliamentary process. And the first one, of which Mpo will be leading on it, on the 2021 draft rates bill, I don't know whether it's Alan or Chris who's sharing the screen, the increase in excise duties on alcohol and tobacco, Chair. You remember during public hearings, there were a lot of comments. So we're just going to zoom there to the 2021 draft rates bill, increase on excise duty on tobacco. Mpo will be leading on this. Thank you, Chair.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning to members of Parliament. As Myanga said, I'll just be focusing on the important issues that were raised on the race bill. The first one was on the issue of the 8% increase. The industry was not happy about the increase of 8%, which is above inflation. And our response is that these increases that we do on an annual basis are taken in the context of the fiscal framework and also looking at the public health imperatives in terms of the implementation of excise excise duties. And related to the question of the increase in the excise rate, there was an issue about the targeted incidence framework that we apply, that the increases takes the targeted incidence above what is currently contained in the framework. And for us, what we have observed is that the annual increases that we make on the excise on a yearly basis, they are not reflected in the prices that the industry implements in terms of their products. So in that instance, the targeted incidence seems to be above what is contained in the framework because there's no pass through. And another issue that was raised was that due to the changes in the market related to lockdown and the growth of illicit that came with restrictions around the sales of products, alcohol and tobacco, that maybe the reference prices should be changed to reflect those dynamics. And for us, the issue is that when we get the tobacco control, currently a pack of 20 is 18 rand 79. So if then we have to change the reference price from the most popular brand to a lower price a brand, basically it will be reversing the tobacco control that we have been implementing over the years, meaning that it will imply that the current rate of 18 rand 79 cent has to be halved in terms of excise. And I don't think that's the way we want to go in terms of tobacco control. Another issue that was raised on the beer side was that the low alcohol beer should be taxed lower, and that we should be thinking about having a differentiated or a multi-tier tax structure for beer. And our response to that is that currently beer is taxed based on alcohol content, so the rate takes into account the low alcohol content beer, because in terms of the tax burden, they'll be paying less than the high alcohol content. And having a multi-tier bent structure will complicate the process and increase administration of the excise rates for beer. There was a time when the structure had about 9 bands, and that was consolidated into one. So we don't see ourselves going back to multi-tier. And when it comes to the issue of heated tobacco products, we are taking a precautionary approach as advised by the World Health Organization in terms of the pricing or the excise that are applicable to heated tobacco products. And in terms of the developments going forward, we'll be observing what is happening in terms of the research that's coming out in terms of the comparison between combusted and versus non-combusted cigarettes, in terms of whether the policy should be reflecting that, taking into account the health considerations of these new generation products. Another important issue that came along with that was that the increases in excise rate, the fuel illicit and illicit market has grown during the lockdown due to the restrictions in the sales of this product. And we're also concerned about that as government, that the illicit market has grown. And since SARSF have put measures in place to capacitate itself, and also working with other law enforcement agencies to crack down on illicit trade. And that has been demonstrated by some of the media reports that have come out from SARS in terms of the confiscations that have done and all of that. And we are quite concerned because illicit trade also impacts on the health objectives of implementing excise tax policy and also on the fiscal. So we are quite concerned, but there are efforts to deal with that. And as Chair, you remember that last time that there was an issue about illicit in terms of SARS giving a full report around that, because we once had a specific workshop around the issue of illicit trade. And I think more details will be provided in that. Thank you very much.
Okay, Chair. Now we have done, we are done with the rates bill, of which those were the most comments that we received on the rates bill, the increase in excise duty on tobacco. So now we are coming to the draft TLAB. The draft TLAB is divided into about four sections. The first one is employment, individuals, and savings. Under employment, individuals, and savings, the first comment that we received, of which are comments here in Parliament all over and even during the workshops, is applying tax on withdrawals of retirement interest when an individual ceases to be a tax resident. Currently, in terms of our tax legislation, when an individual ceases to be a South African tax resident before that individual retires and becomes a tax resident of another country, the income from retirement fund may be subject to the tax in that other country. And the rationale for this is because of the application of the double taxation agreements between South Africa and that other country, as the provisions of the tax treaty will apply if the individual becomes resident maybe of UK, that individual, when that individual retire, will be taxed as resident in the UK, and the income from retirement funds will be subject to tax in the UK, not South Africa. So in order to address this, in the 2021 draft TLAB, we made proposals to say that when an individual ceases to be a South African tax resident, the retirement fund interest will form part of the assets that are subject to retirement withdrawal tax, and the individual will be deemed to have withdrawn from the fund on the day before he or she ceases to be a South African tax resident. That principle is the same principle that is available on the capital gains tax, whereby we have a deemed disposal before an individual ceases to be tax resident. Coming to the comments, we received a lot of comments on this, also in Parliament, and then there was something on News 24 as well. The issue on the comments was that the taxpayers during the workshops, they understood the rationale for this. However, there was a view that we are bypassing tax treaties with domestic legislation, and that is controversial and could result in double taxation for members of retirement funds. And the cases that the taxpayers cited was the scenario whereby in Netherlands, the Netherlands introduced the air provision in its domestic tax law, and Netherlands government was taken to court because they were saying that the provisions that you have introduced in the domestic law after you have negotiated and entered into tax treaties, and those provisions have got a tendency of overriding the tax treaties, it is a breach of good faith, thereby resulting in treaty override. So after looking at the international precedent, what Netherlands has done and the comments that went into Netherlands and the fact that the Netherlands lost this in court, we decided that the proposed changes that were made regarding the introduction of new Section 9HC will be removed from the 2021 draft TLAB. So the final TLAB that will be tabled by the minister tomorrow will not have Section 9HC. That said, we're going to look at, we have to introduce this amendment because the policy rationale for this amendment is well understood, but we have to look at the amendment that is not going to cause a friction with regard to the tax treaties, breach of good faith, and thereby resulting in treaty override. So the proposal here is to withdraw Section 9HC from the 2021 draft TLAB. Next slide. I don't know whether Chris, you had something to add in this regard.
No, that's fine. Thanks, Yanga.
The second one is capping abuse in the employment tax incentive. In the 2021 draft TLAB, we proposed certain measures whereby we wanted to cap abuse in the Employment Tax Incentive Act, because it came to our attention that some taxpayers have devised certain schemes to claim the incentive in respect of individuals who do not work for them, but are rather engaged in training program using training institution. So what we did in the 2021 draft TLAB, we said we introduced measures to say work must actually be performed in terms of an employment contract. The employee must be documented in the employer's record as envisaged in the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. And in view of the fact that we were trying to close a loophole, you'll remember, Chair, when we're doing the informal briefings, We said there are about four to five dates that had retrospective effective date. And this capping of the abuse of the employment tax incentive was one of them. Next slide. We received comments on the proposed amendment to say that the proposed amendment to Section 6 results in what actually legitimate ETI claims no longer qualify for the incentive. So we accepted that because by doing this, we did not want to close, we wanted to close the loophole on the illegitimate ETI claims. So we accepted this and changes will be made in the 2021 draft TLEP, the TLEP that will be tabled by the minister tomorrow to rectify this. The next one is that the proposed amendment's effective date should rather be postponed and consideration should be given to postponing the effective date from 1 March 2021 to 28 July, which is the date of the publication of the draft TLEP. The response to this is partially accepted. As we have said in the informal briefings, given the uncertainty around specific issues pertaining to the draft legislation and the interest of ensuring that claims that would have otherwise been legitimate are not deemed unlawful, it is only based on this reason that the effective date is being postponed, because normally, if we are closing an abusive scheme, that we always want the effective date to be retrospective. So now, because of the fact that we do not want to close legitimate claims, ETI claims, so the effective date will be moved from 1 March 2021 to 1 March 2022. The other comment was more of a technical nature, whereby it was noted that paragraphs A to D of the definition of employee in the ETI Act are intended to be applied cumulatively. It is, however, unclear how paragraph C is intended to apply. So that is more of a technical nature. So we're going to make changes to the draft TLEP and paragraph C. And the definition of employee in the ETI is not intended as an alternative to paragraph A. So these changes will be made in the ETI Act. I don't know if Chris, you've got something to add.
No, that's also good.
The last one on the employment is strengthening anti-avoidance rules in respect of loan transfers between trusts. It is important to know that on the individual, we've only picked these three because these are the ones that taxpayers brought to Parliament during public hearings. Currently, the Income Tax Act has got rules that cap the transfer of wealth to trust using low interest or interest-free loans in order to avoid estate duty and donations tax on the asset subsequent growth in value. So these rules were introduced in 2016. In 2017 and 2020, we keep on making changes to the legislation because taxpayers were coming with further schemes to avoid those rules. So in the 2021 budget review, proposals were made in Annex C about further tax avoidance schemes between trusts where the founder of one trust holding the original asset is related to one or more beneficiaries of the other trust to which the loan asset is transferred. And based on that, we made changes in the 2021 draft TLEP. Comment. Next slide. You remember, most people came to Parliament in this. Like, I remember kids from SIGHT in this regard. They were saying that the proposed amendments aim to ensure that the anti-avoidance measures apply in respect of any loans, advance, or credit that a trust directly or indirectly provides to a trust in relation to which its beneficiaries or the founder are connected person, in relation to the founder of beneficiaries of the trust that provided the loan. However, Section 7C was originally introduced to counter schemes where a person transfers his or her own growth assets to a trust in return for a fixed loan without interest in order to avoid wealth taxes. Those wealth taxes is like donations tax and estate duty. So the view was that the proposed amendment is going too far. And then the comment was that the proposed amendment should be withdrawn and an alternative anti-avoidance measures be introduced which are aimed at the specific mischief. So our response to this, we accept that based on the policy rationale for the introduction of Section 7C, whereby it was meant to cap the use of low interest-bearing or interest-free loans in order to avoid estate duty and donations tax on the subsequent growth of assets in value. Based on the fact that the main aim of 7C was only that, so we understood that this amendment may be going too far than what the main aim of Section 7C is. So the response to this, we've accepted the comment. We're going to withdraw the proposed changes to Section 7C in the Income Tax Act on the 2021 draft TLAB. The 2021 TLAB that will be tabled by the minister will not be having Section 7 Cap C, and we will consider specific amendments in the next legislative cycle. So now we are finished with the individual taxes. So we are going now to the business tax general. Hayley will be leading this.
Thanks, Yanga. Can everyone, good morning, Chair and members of Parliament. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, darling. Go ahead.
Okay, sure. So with respect to the rules that we currently have in our legislation that basically limit the interest deductions in respect of debts owed to persons not subject to tax, these have been in the law since 2013 and basically apply in respect of amounts of interest that are incurred after January 2015. And I'm sure most of you have heard about base erosion and profit shifting. So one of the main aims of these rules is to limit excessive interest deductions so that our corporate tax base is not eroded. And on the 26th of February last year, so on the day of the budget, we published a discussion document that was titled Reviewing the Tax Treatment of Excessive Debt Financing, Interest Deductions and Other Financial Payments. And basically, what this review sought to do was to review the current rules, and this was in comparison to what came out of the OECD BEPS project. And we realized through that review that our rules were essentially they needed to be amended in a few ways. So at the bottom of the slide here, we've just listed what we sought to do. So, for example, we expanded the meaning of the term interest for the purpose of these rules. And instead of having a ratio that's based, so how the rules work is it limits your interest expense based on a ratio of your earnings. And currently that ratio is linked to a formula. And in line with the OECD project, we've proposed that we move to a fixed ratio of 30%. And we've also tried to reduce the opportunities for companies to avoid the rules with back-to-back loans. So essentially what companies can do is to try and route the debt through a third party so that those interest deductions are not caught by these rules. We also sought to amend the definition of adjusted taxable income, particularly for real estate investment trusts. And then lastly, we sort of tried to equalize the treatment and the interaction based on the level of tax in the current rules. So currently, depending on which country the interest payment flows to, and the treaty rate that's applicable for withholding taxes, the rules apply or not. So we've also sought to do an amendment in that regard because most other countries that apply these rules don't actually consider what happens to the interest income on the other side, whereas our rules currently do. Next slide, thanks. So in terms of the comments we received, the predominant concern by taxpayers was timing. So as you're all aware, companies' earnings have been affected by COVID. And the concern was that if this proposal is introduced in the years where impact of COVID is still felt, that interest deductibility would be further impacted by significantly lower earnings in the current and post-COVID pandemic years. So for this comment, we've accepted it. The measure was first proposed just before COVID reached South Africa. However, we still have the view that the current rules are an important tool to mitigate against the use of excessive debt. So in this regard, we would still like to go ahead with strengthening these rules. But we do understand that many businesses have had to rely on more debt. And this has also been in conjunction with lower earnings over the past 19 months or so. So because of this, this provides basically the rationale for why we'd like to propose this measure, which was proposed as part of a corporate income tax package. So what we've proposed is that the proposal will remain in the draft TLAB. However, it will only come into operation when the Minister of Finance announces a reduction in the corporate tax rate to keep them as part of the same package. Next slide. Can you go one back, please? Yep. So we also received a comment that the 30% ratio is generally applicable to developed countries and not countries.
Can I just come in?
Sure.
The previous slide, sorry. So there just can't be any misunderstanding. I think the point is that this reform is linked to whether there's changes made in a corporate income tax. So I would just say, if and when the minister makes changes to the corporate income tax rate. So, Chair, and I'm saying this just to say that this is just giving effect to the announcements made previously, last year and this year, and it's meant to say that if the minister were, for example, to announce that there's a change in a corporate rate, then this will take effect. So we're not trying to preempt and say what announcements will be made next year. I just want to clarify that, because we're not making new policy decisions through the MTEC. And that's why when I started, I said we are merely expanding on the announcements made in February this year. I don't know if you want to add on, Hayley.
No, that's perfect, by the way. Thanks for interjecting. All right. No, I think that clarifies it nicely. Then in terms of other comments that we received, so that the ratio that we've proposed is more in line with what is suitable for developed countries than developing countries like South Africa, we didn't accept this proposal, and this is because South Africa is not the only developing country that has these rules in place and has implemented a 30% rate. So, for example, Botswana and India have introduced it at the same level. And when we introduced these rules, some of the analysis that we did at that time, so it was 2015, we did think at that point, and we made it clear to taxpayers in a previous explanatory memo and response document, that we thought the ratio at that point, which was introduced at a level of 40%, was too high, even though interest rates at the time were higher than they are currently. So we feel comfortable with this level, and most companies will be able to deduct all of their interest expenses. Then with respect to these rules apply in cases where there's a controlling relationship between companies. However, it's basically the way the current law was written is that you need a vertical relationship, and it didn't recognize that you could also have horizontal relationships. So for example, if you've got a multinational corporation, and there's a loan advance from a treasury company that's a subsidiary of the South African borrower, we'd also like the rules to apply in that case. So we welcome the comments from the taxpayers that pointed that out to us, and we will be making changes in that regard. All right. And then, so with this one, the comment received was that this proposal should only apply in cases where the interest is not subject to tax at all, and that it's inappropriate to adjust for rate considerations, particularly when the base is different. So as I tried to explain earlier, what happened here is South Africa's rules currently apply in instances where there's no tax at all on the corresponding interest income, whereas most other countries and the OECD rules did not have that requirement. So other countries that have these rules don't consider what happens to interest on the other side. The rules apply regardless. So we didn't go that far. What we thought would be a more fair approach was to equalize the treatment. So essentially the portion of interest that is not taxed at the standard withholding tax rate will be subject to these rules. So what we did was we kept our approach, but we moved away from using the corporate tax rate as the reference, and we've accepted that we should use the 15% withholding tax rate. All right, then in terms of the other base broadening measure that was part of the corporate tax package, so as Momo mentioned, we had proposed the corporate tax package, which was going to reduce the corporate tax rate in conjunction with two base broadening measures. So this was the second one. So here we propose to restrict how much of an assessed loss taxpayers could set off against their taxable income. So currently, when a taxpayer determines their taxable income, they can look to prior year losses and offset those against current year taxable income. And if those losses exceed the current year taxable income, they can carry forward that amount to future years. So there's no restriction at all. Basically, then taxpayers become liable to pay tax once they've earned a taxable profit and their assessed loss balance is depleted. So one of the reasons for having this in the system is for symmetry in the corporate tax system. And also to recognize that not all companies have sort of stable income. So some businesses are cyclical in nature, and that it's, and it's not in line with the standard tax year. And this is also the case, for example, for startup companies that are not profitable in the early years of trading. However, what we've seen over the past few years is that there's been an international trend to apply provisions like this, where you restrict the use of assessed losses, which provides the fiscal room to reduce the corporate income tax rate. So as a measure to try and improve the country's competitiveness and reduce the appeal of base erosion and profit shifting, as well as encourage investment and promote economic growth, you'll know that the Minister of Finance announced previously in the 2020 budget review that government has the intention to restructure the corporate income tax system. And it's important to point out that this would be in a revenue neutral manner. So it would not have a cost for the fiscus. So following on from this, in this draft TLAB, it was proposed that the corporate income tax base is broadened. And to do this, the proposal was that assessed losses carried forward could only be set off up to 80% of taxable income. So in other words, if you have 100 Rand of taxable income for the current year, but you've got 120 Rand of assessed losses, you're not able to set off the full amount of taxable income. You can only offset it up to 80 Rand. So in effect, taxpayers would have to pay tax on the remaining 20 Rand balance, but it simply results in a timing difference. So the overall tax liability won't change, and a portion of the tax liability is brought forward. Thanks. Next slide. So in terms of the comments that we got, the biggest comment was that many of the taxpayers understand and appreciate the overall objective of what we were trying to achieve with the corporate tax package, with lowering the rate and broadening the base. But again, like I said in the previous measure, one of the biggest concerns was timing, and that this proposal was too harsh, considering that we've just had the pandemic and the recent unrest. And many businesses, and this goes across sectors and size, have suffered losses as a result of the pandemic and the lockdowns. So the concern was that having to use cash to pay tax on 20% of taxable income rather than using cash to recover was not necessarily the best idea. We've also seen that many of the countries that have these measures have temporarily relaxed their regimes as part of the relief measures to support businesses in these times. So we propose to accept this measure. It was, as the last measure was proposed before COVID reached South Africa. And government still holds the view that a broad base with as few distortions as possible is better, combined with a lower rate, as it's more efficient. And this is an important tax policy design principle. However, it's important that government acknowledges that businesses have faced difficult circumstances in the past 19 months. So some businesses are in survival mode, and we think that providing the space for recovery is important. So for this reason, and in line with what Momo mentioned earlier, is that it will have the same, we've done the same with this one. So it will be retained in the draft TLAB, but this will be pending a decision by our minister to lower the corporate tax rate. Okay. Then the second biggest comment we received was that the impact of this measure would be different for different businesses, and there were concerns raised in the cases of, for example, businesses like agriculture that are cyclical in nature, startups and smaller businesses. So this we've partially accepted, and something that I think we've made clear in the past is the general stance that government has in terms of providing carve-outs within tax policy. So from our perspective, we don't think they're a good thing because they provide special treatment to some taxpayers, and this can also lead to complexity. So doing so does raise the potential for creating vested interest for those that do benefit from measures, and also makes it difficult to adapt the original policy choice if we basically becomes apparent that it's no longer ideally designed or no longer fit for its original objectives. And what we've also found is that it means that government is continually exposed to lobbying from those that don't benefit from any carve-outs. So while we do consider that the proposed restriction is relatively generous, so many other countries that have these measures in place have a percentage that's lower than 80%. And also it's not strict in the sense that companies will forfeit their losses because the balance of assessed losses will still continue to be carried forward indefinitely. Government does recognize that not all businesses are equally equipped with the cash on hand to pay a tax liability once taxable income turns positive for the first time after a sustained period of accumulated losses. So basically to cater for all sectors and recognize not all companies have sufficient cash flow, what we are proposing is that changes be made in the draft TLAB to introduce a de minimis threshold beyond which this measure will apply. And the aim of this is basically to provide relief for a variety of companies that may experience cash flow challenges at different times. And so what we've proposed is that to the extent that the balance of assessed losses exceeds 80% of current year taxable income, companies will be able to set off the higher of 1 million or 80% of taxable income when calculating their current tax liability. And while other countries do have higher thresholds, they also have stricter restrictions in place. And by doing it at this level, it basically means that the corporate income tax package will not move too far away from its aim of revenue neutrality. And this is important given the currently constrained fiscal space. Then we also received a few other concerns from particular sectors. So one example was the agriculture sector who presented in Parliament. So this we've said we partially accepted because we have now gone with the proposal for the de minimis rule. But after we presented our response, someone from the agricultural sector did recognize that losses are not being forfeited. They can still be carried forward indefinitely. So I think with that better understanding in place, there was more of an acceptance that the measure wasn't as bad as initially thought. We also received comments from the real estate investment trust industry and non-listed property companies. So the concern there is that the proposal combined with no extension of tax benefits for REITs to unlisted property companies means that most, if not all, of unlisted property funds will pay tax, and that this reinforces the uneven playing field between listed REITs and unlisted property companies. So here we've said that we partially accept this and we can understand where the concern comes from. However, the challenge is that the proposal itself is not the root cause of the problem. So providing a carve out for this particular measure is not deemed from government's perspective to be the best way of addressing the concern. And the underlying challenge is basically a lack of regulation of unlisted property companies, which is a matter that needs to be attended to. We also received comments from insurance companies, and this was particular to the individual policyholder fund. The concern there was that this is a corporate tax measure, but it will apply to the IPF. And this fund consists solely of individuals who are not intended to fall within the scope of the amendment. And they won't get the same relief if the corporate tax rate is reduced. So here we also see the concern. However, we have not accepted this. Government does acknowledge that this measure would affect individuals with investments in IPFs. However, the tax rate of 30% applied to these funds is already lower than most of the individuals' marginal tax rate that are within these funds. And of course, while we would prefer that the actual marginal tax rates apply to on an individual basis for these funds specifically, it is recognized that this is not the solution for the challenge. And so government commits to reinvestigate the tax rate applied in respect of the IPF. However, in respect of the specific proposal, no special treatment will be granted to the IPF. Thanks.
Okay, Chair, thank you. The next slide on business tax general, we are dealing with the proposed changes that we made in the 2021 draft TLEP regarding clarifying the hypothecation of collateral within collateral lending arrangements. In 2015, we introduced relief measures in the Tax Act, that is the Securities Transfer Tax Act, to allow for the tax neutral transfer of collateral between parties, provided that they meet certain requirements as legislated in the Act. So it came to our attention that there are issues regarding rehypothecation of collateral where the bank, broker, or dealer intends to use the collateral received through a tax-neutral collateral arrangement for trading or as security for its own borrowing. And this is against the policy rationale. So in the 2021 draft TLEP, we made these proposed amendments that the shares or bonds transferred as collateral in terms of the collateral arrangement may only be subsequently used for collateral and not used for trading or other financial transactions. Secondly, and that the transferee enter into a contractual arrangement and agrees that the listed share or listed bonds transferred are going to be used only for the collateral arrangement. And thirdly, in view of the fact that we were trying to close a loophole or an abuse, effective date of this legislation was retrospective of this amendment. It was applying from 28 July 2021, when the day we published the draft TLEP for public comments. Like in any other years, we received a lot of comments. I remember people who came to Parliament, BASA and GSE. Next slide. The comments that we received was, there is no need to introduce the proposed legislative limitation in this regard, as the existing legislation is perfectly adequate in ensuring that any reuse of collateral outside of a further collateral arrangement will fall within the tax net. When this one, we consulted a lot because there were public hearings on the 31st of August, there were workshops on the 8th of September, and also we have a consultative meeting on the 4th of October. And in all these three public comment processes, the taxpayers were saying that there is no reason for this legislation because it is well understood. But we had a problem with that because there are some taxpayers who requested clarity regarding the application of this provision. So if the taxpayers request clarity regarding the application of these provisions, that implies that the law is not clear. So hence we made proposals in the budget to make changes in the legislation. So the view is that we feel that the changes are still required in the legislation because taxpayers did request clarification of the law, and the proposed changes to the legislation are important because they provide clarification. The second comment was that regarding the retrospective effective date of these amendments, to say that the proposed amendments will touch on legitimate transactions. So we understood that, and then we agreed that changes will be made in the 2021 draft TLEP to postpone the effective date from date of publication of the draft TLEP, that is from 28 July 2021 to 1 January 2022. The third comment that we received, which goes with the previous comment, because in this legislation we've proposed that there should be, taxpayers should enter into an agreement when they enter into contractual arrangement. They should enter into a contractual arrangement when they enter into these collateral arrangements. So taxpayers commented to say that we can't have that provision in the legislation as it will be cumbersome. So we're going to remove the requirement for a contractual agreement in this regard. So that requirement will be removed from the draft legislation. Another comment that we received during the public consultation process was that government recognize and support the fact that we have to do this. However, there is a view that the current proposed wording is very wide and impacts and threatens to have material negative impact on both regulatory conduct and liquidity stability of and the attractiveness of the South Africa capital markets. And taxpayers took us back to 2015 as to the rationale why we have these proposed amendments. And during the consultative meeting on the 4th of October, taxpayers cited the following. If we make these changes, if we proceed with these changes as they are in the 2021 draft TLEP, they will impact on the following. Inability of banks and pension funds to meet regulatory obligations. Banks being unable to reuse collateral for HULL purposes. Inability of pension funds to now meet Regulation 28 requirements. Reuse of collateral for security optimization within bank or pension funds. The sale and transfer of securities by the banks to the sub, which securities include outright non-cash collateral taken by banks, and the large exposure framework. Based on these comments, we partially accepted their comments, and changes are proposed in the 2021 TLEP that will be tabled by the minister, whereby we've taken some of the few regulatory concerns that are listed in the comments above. So changes will be made in the 2021 draft TLEP to accommodate the following regulated transactions and current market and regulatory developments. That is, we're going to only accommodate the following. A repurchase agreement entered into with SARB in terms of Section 101J of the South African Reserve Bank Act, complying with Regulation 28 of the Pension Funds Act, securing overnight cash placement in order to comply with Basel III supervisory framework for measuring and controlling large exposures. So changes will be made in the 2021 draft TLEP to only accommodate these three regulatory frameworks. And we have already changed the effective date to be 1 January 2022. So the effective date is no longer retrospective. The next one on the agenda is clarifying the definition of contributed tax capital. As we have said during the public hearings, this concept of contributed tax capital was introduced in the Income Tax Act in 2008. And it was consequential amendment in the Income Tax Act because amendments were made in the Companies Act. And because Companies Act was changing, so we were forced to make these changes. So it came to our attention that some companies are exploiting the current provisions of the contributed tax collateral, contributed tax capital, by allocating CTC on the basis of an alleged share premium contributed by a particular shareholder, but not all shareholders holding shares in the same class of shares. To address this, we made changes in the 2021 draft TLEP. Also, because we were closing an abusive schemes, the changes were made to apply retrospectively from the date of publication of the draft TLEP, which is 28 July 2021. we receive comments to say that the proposed amendment seeks to clarify the principle that shareholders within the same class of shares should equally in relation to their shareholding shares in the allocation of CTC as a result of a distribution. However, the proposed wording seems to be far wider and has unintended consequences. So we accepted that. However, we limited the changes to be made in the 2021 draft TLEB to say that changes will be made in the 2021 draft TLEB to exclude a general repurchase of listed shares, that is share buybacks by companies listed on the JSE or other South African exchanges. The rationale for excluding only listed companies is that throughout the Income Tax Act, there is a relief that is granted for listed companies because there is a view that if you are operating within the listed company space, there is less avoidance because there are regulations of the JSE or other South African exchanges that are regulating those companies. Hence, you find that throughout the Income Tax Act, there is a relief granted in respect of listed companies. Next slide. The current proviso to the definition of CTC states that the amount transferred by a company must not exceed an amount that bears to the total amount of contributed tax capital to the class of shares immediately before the transfer, the same ratio as the number of shares of that class held by that person bears to the total number of shares of that class. So the view was that this wording in the current proviso creates unintended tax consequences. So we are not accepting this comment because we are saying that in the 2021 Annexure C tax proposal, we propose to make amendments on another part, not to this part. So this comment falls outside the context of the proposed amendment in the 2021 draft TLEB. The next slide, the next comment was the issues regarding the retrospective effective date, of which I've already touched on. And we agree that changes will be made in the 2021 draft TLEB to change the retrospective effective date of the proposed amendment from the date of publication to 1 January 2022. The last one on business tax is refining the interaction between anti-value shifting rules and corporate reorganization rules. Currently, the Act has got anti-value shifting rules in terms of Section 24BA and 40CA that kept the use of structures that shift value between taxpayers free of tax. On the other hand, you've got corporate reorganization rules in Chapter 2 of the Act that allows for the tax-neutral transfer of assets between companies. It came to our attention that the anti-value shifting rules in Section 24BA and 40CA, as well as corporate reorganization rules, there's a friction when you apply those two provisions together. As a result, we propose changes to be made in the 2021 draft TLEB in this regard. However, the comment was that the proposed changes are welcomed. They were happy with this. However, it was noted that the proposal for the additional base costs only to be deemed to arise immediately prior to a subsequent disposal introduces an additional complexity and admin burden. So we accepted the proposal, the comment, and changes will be made in the 2021 draft TLEB to ensure that the additional base cost uplift in this regard is granted immediately after an asset for share transaction that is subject to the anti-value shifting rules. As a consequential amendment, an additional legislative change will be made to Section 41 of the Act to ensure that the reorganization rules are made subject to the immediate base cost uplift. So I think the taxpayers will be happy with this because we've accepted all the comments that they've put forward. The next one is international tax, clarifying the controlled foreign company anti-diversionary rules. I think South Africa, we've got controlled foreign company rules, and these rules are more so aligned to developed countries because if you've got residence-based system of taxation whereby you tax your taxpayers, your tax resident on your worldwide income, you would want to have anti-avoidance provisions aimed at taxing South African residents on the net income of a controlled foreign company. That is a company that is more than 50% controlled by South African residents. So if South African resident has got a company which is more than 50, a foreign company which is more than 50% owned by the South African resident, the net income of that contract foreign company is included in the income of a South African tax resident. So it has come to our attention that certain taxpayers are circumventing the rules by merely entering into a contract of purchase in the country of the CFC. That implies that the purchase of the goods took place in the country of residence of the CFC when the goods are never physically present in that country. So in the 2021 draft TLAB, we made changes to the diversionary rules focusing on the purchase of goods. And we made changes to say that when a CFC purchases those goods should be delivered in the country of residence of that CFC. Because we have seen contracts whereby the South African resident and the CFC will enter into a contract for the purchase of goods, but the goods will never be delivered in the country of residence of that controlled foreign company. So by merely entering into a contract for the purchase of goods, but the goods are never delivered, that is an anti-avoidance scheme. So we are making changes to the 2021 draft TLAB to close that anti-avoidance scheme. So the comment that we received, the concern relating to the mere conclusion of contacts in the country of residence of the CFC is acknowledged. However, the proposed amendments are too restrictive to CFC that enter into genuine business transactions with persons outside of the country of residence of the CFC. The response, we do not accept this because while government acknowledges the business practices, this loophole in the diversionary rule should be closed. So we do not accept this, although we understand that there are legitimate businesses, but there is no way we can close this or we can take care of this except that changes are made in the legislation. The second comment was that the references in the explanatory memorandum to the 2021 draft TLAB of anti-diversionary rules for CFC outbound sale of goods are inappropriate, so we should make changes. That we accept. It's a mistake that we have made in the EM, so we're going to clarify the EM. The next comments are in VET. Anissa Bey, who's the specialist of the VET, will lead in this regard. Thank you, Chair.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, members. With regard to VAT, the amendments that we are proposing have to do with the VAT treatment of temporary letting of residential immovable property. Now, generally, when immovable property is transferred, we all know that it's subject to transfer duty. However, when a developer does the transfer, then it's subject to VAT because the developer would be a VAT vendor in most instances. And that would be subject to the standard rate of VAT of 15%. This would then entitle the property developer to claim input tax credits on expenses incurred in developing the property. However, leasing of residential fixed property is an exempt supply for VAT purposes. And generally, when it comes to exempt supplies, the input tax is denied. Now, the problem that arose is that property developers, sometimes when the market is bad, are unable to dispose of the property within a reasonable time. And in the period in which it takes them to find a buyer, they are generally still paying costs, the expenses such as bank charges that they incur on loans. So developers have taken to leasing out these residential fixed property in that interim period. Now, the concern was that in that interim period, what the VAT Act required was that an output tax adjustment needed to be made, and it had to be made on the open market value of the residential fixed property. Developers were concerned that this was a bit harsh because the open market value is obviously higher than the costs that they've incurred. The rationale behind this in the VAT Act was that when the developer claimed the input tax credits, it was with the intention that the fixed property is trading stock, is something that he will sell and declare an output tax when he sells it. But in the interim, now he's making an exempt supply, which is the leasing. We required that input tax actually be paid back to the fiscus. So the open market value, if you base the input tax on that, would be too high. And the request was that we we look at that valuation. And we then propose looking at the amending that valuation instead of awkward market value being what's called the fixed cost, which is the actual cost to the developer of developing the property. And that would then put him in the same footing he would have been in had he sold the property. The concerns were further raised with regard to there were various concerns regarding how this provision applied, whether on the sale of this in the future, whether there would still be VAT applicable, or whether the exempt supply meant that the entire transaction had left the VAT net. So we needed to clarify all of this within the VAT Act. Next slide, please. Okay, so one of the comments was that when we talk about the developer letting this property in the interim period, we talk about temporary let, and the concern was that the word temporary was very subjective and that it would lead to uncertainty in interpretation, and the taxpayers required clarification on this. So what we're proposing now, we've accepted the comment, we're proposing to include a definition of temporary applied, so that would provide the clarity. The other comment was that the VAT payable is still disproportionate to the exempt income earned on the rental, and that there was a proposal that we use a formula to clarify the input tax and the output tax adjustments that are due, and that formula must be similar to one used in Australia. Now, we've partially accepted this comment. We are proposing this amendment in order to ease the burden on the taxpayer. So from having to make the amendment on open market value to adjusted cost, that's already easing the burden because it's a lower value. And what we then decided to do is that we would then provide further clarity on the input tax and output tax adjustments that were causing confusion. Next slide. So the other comment was that the proposed amendments are not clear on what the situation would be where the developer chooses to permanently apply the fixed property for rental income. We've accepted that comment, and the clarity we will be providing will basically state that in such instances, the provisions of Section 18.1 will apply, which implies that the transaction would have left the VAT net completely. The other comment is that the wording in its current form creates the perception that the purchase of the property will only be liable for the VAT to the extent of the difference between the purchase price and the adjusted cost. So we had put all of this in one provision, and it created that confusion that the purchaser will only be liable for the difference. So we've accepted that comment and decided that that one provision will be split out to discuss the input tax and the output tax separately, and this will also address the issue of what happens when the property is sold at a loss. The other comment was that the date of implementation was too late, that developers have been struggling with this from January 2018, and April 2022 will be too late to make this adjustment. They request that we backdate this either to 1st of January 2018, when the first relief was withdrawn, or to when the first lockdown began on the 26th of March. This comment we have not accepted because the amendments to tax legislation are usually only made retrospectively in instances of anti-avoidance measures. These proposed amendments are intended to provide relief to a specific sector of vendors and not to all vendors, and that is property developers registered for VAT. So they already have the benefit of having a provision specially for that sector. And so looking at it further retrospectively would be continuous disadvantage to other taxpayers. That's it for the VAT. Thank you.
Thank you. I think Charlene will be leading on carbon tax.
Good morning, Chair and members of Parliament. So we introduced the carbon tax in June 2019, and as part of the design of the tax for the first phase up to December 2023, we provide for what we call electricity price neutrality. So where there are electricity generators, they can offset the payment of the electricity generation levy that currently applies. So that payment, as well as additional purchases of renewable electricity against their carbon tax liability. And this was to minimize and address concerns by stakeholders at the time around possible double taxation due to the Renewable Energy Independent Power Producer program that was implemented. So as part of the engagements prior to the 2021 announcements, there were requests from taxpayers, and there were concerns regarding who are the intended beneficiaries of this concession, and specifically the required clarity on whether renewable electricity generated by particular industries and that electricity which is wheeled through the national grid, whether they would be able to claim this renewable energy premium deduction. So in the 2021 TLAB, we sought to clarify who would be liable, sort of who would actually benefit from this, which is those that conduct electricity generation activities. And we specifically clarified that this is for the purchase of additional renewable electricity where a power purchase agreement exists. Next slide. So in clarifying that part around the PPPs, the comments from stakeholders were essentially that the broader clarifications on this deduction were supported. However, there were concerns around the reference to PPAs. There was a view that this would create uncertainty, as there could be several types of power purchase agreements in existence. One in particular that was referenced by taxpayers was to the extent that there might be some sort of on-site renewable-based electricity generation where a taxpayer might enter into agreement with a third party to purchase electricity. And this would not be wheeled through the national grids. There was a request for clarification around whether this renewable electricity purchase would be eligible for the premium deduction. There was a recommendation provided by the taxpayers that there should be clarity provided on the type of PPAs that would be eligible in the explanatory memorandum. So this comment was accepted. We do recognize that there are two types of PPAs that do exist for on-site electricity generation and secondly for off-site electricity generation where electricity is supplied and purchased and this electricity is supplied through the national grid there. So we've made those clarifications in the EM to clarify that off-site electricity generation would be eligible, but on-site electricity generation would not be eligible. Next slide. The second issue, so under the carbon tax, we provide for emissions sequestered or emissions stored in plantations and forests and through carbon capture and storage, that those emissions can be deducted from the combustion emissions, so more electricity generation emissions of taxpayers. And this formed part of the concessions under the broader carbon tax. We've had various consultations and especially through the Department of Environment Affairs. So for this particular sequestration deduction, those emissions sequestered must be certified and verified by the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment. In the case of biological sequestration, so stored in plants and forests, in the TLAB we had proposed that the biological sequestration will be limited to forestry plantations. The Department of Environment had put out a set of sequestration guidelines, and in this it provided the methodologies for determining emissions sequestered in forests, as well as emissions sequestered in what is called harvested wood products. So essentially a furniture, et cetera, that is produced from forestry material. So this guideline was put out by the Department of Environment, and it outlined the methodologies that are to be used to calculate the emissions sequestered from forestry plantations. At the time, we were concerned around the sequestration in harvested wood products, and the concern was from an administrative and technical perspective around the actual permanence of this emission sequestered in harvested wood products, how this would be measured, and the methodologies that that would be used. And in light of that, we had proposed in the T-Lab to limit sequestration deduction to forestry plantations only and to exclude harvested wood products. Next slide. As part of the comments that came in, mainly through the industry, there were concerns that, you know, the methodological guideline published by the Department of Forestry, Fishery and Environment was consulted over several years in developing the methodologies for carbon sequestration. This forms part of the processes around greenhouse gas emissions reporting regulations. There was a view that the methodologies are adequate and they address concerns that were raised around the permanence of these emissions that are sequestered in harvested wood products, and it can basically be calculated and it can be verified by the department. And there was a request that this the definition of sequestration for purposes of the carbon tax includes both forestry plantations as well as harvested wood products and is aligned with the carbon guidelines of the Department of Forestry. This comment was accepted after consultations with the industry as well as with the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment. So the T-Lab will be amended to expand the scope of this deduction to include harvested wood products. This would be based on the methodology published by the Department of Environment in the sequestration guideline, which accounts for the flows of carbon there. We also take note, and in particular for this discussion, that going forward, there are more stringent and correct methodologies applicable that could be used, for example, using a 100-year accounting approach to basically work out the emissions sequestered in harvested wood products. And this is a process that will be led by the Department of Environment as well as industry in refining this methodology, which we would also take into account going into the future. Next slide. And lastly, the carbon tax that came into effect, so all the greenhouse gas emissions that are subject to the carbon tax are based on emissions that are reported to the Department of Environment. The Schedule 2 of the carbon tax outlines the different activities, and Schedule 1 provides all of the emission factors, etc., that must be used to calculate emissions. So annually, we need to align the activities covered under Schedule 2 of the Carbon Tax Act with the activities that are required to be reported to the Department of Environment. And these adjustments are to take into account changes in activities and inclusion of new activities, as well as changes to thresholds for different activities that must now report emissions to the Department of Environment. Next slide. So for this, for the T-Lab, we included some of those activities. The comments that came in from stakeholders, which we have accepted, were that applying the effective date from the 11th of September 2020, which was aligned with the changes that were made to the Department of Environment greenhouse gas emission reporting regulations, there was a concern that this would result in a retrospective change in legislation. There were also concerns from an admin perspective in terms of filing of tax returns, because this would submissions for filing tax returns would have been due by the 29th of July 2021 for the 2020 tax period. So there were particular recommendations to align the Schedule 2 changes with the tax period for the carbon tax, and to look to bring this into effect from the 1st of Jan 2021. So this amendment and proposal was accepted. So the T-Lab will be changed for the effective date for the Schedule 2 amendments to become to be 1st of January 2021. Thanks.
thank you, Chair. I finished with the PLAB. So the next item on the agenda is TALAB, France.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning, members. So I will try and move through this relatively quickly since I'm conscious of the time. The first item that we are looking at is around the receipts for tax-deductible donations. The proposal here is that we expand the information required in the receipts, or at least give the Commissioner the power to do so. The comment we got back here was the idea of third-party reporting for public benefit organizations may be problematic for the smaller ones. And our response here is that we completely appreciate that. We would be looking at a simpler reporting mechanism for those smaller PBOs. But we think that the reporting would assist both the people who want to give donations to the PBOs, because it would make their lives a lot simpler. We could pre-populate the donations in their tax returns, and they wouldn't have to worry about essentially fake certificates or other things being done. And for that very reason, it would also assist the PBOs, because they wouldn't have to get involved in situations where essentially their receipting systems have been hijacked by people trying to exploit the tax system. So moving on to the next item, and that would be the next slide, please. The administrative non-compliance penalties. The idea here is that at the moment, although we are empowered to impose a penalty if you don't submit this reconciliation, the problem is what do we impose it on if you haven't submitted the reconciliation? So the proposal here was to allow SARS to make an estimate and then base the penalty on the estimate and then adjust it as required when the information actually came in. There's a question as to how we would then calculate it, and we've given a little bit of background as to what the kinds of sources of information we would be using. Moving on to the next slide. The other question that was then raised was, well, that may require adjustments, and our point here is that that happens in other penalty systems where estimates are made. So it's something we would need to monitor, but that the system should be able to handle it. The next comment pointed out that there are two different ways, that there were two different ways you could be supplying your EMP 501 and that SARS' systems appeared to be treating them inconsistently. We tried to explore this one and we couldn't find any reason why the SARS systems would. We got back to the commentator that had raised this point and it went back to the member that had raised it. And it seems to have been a once-off as far as we can tell. But we've asked them to monitor the situation. And if that member or anybody else comes up with a problem, they should be bringing it to us so that we can resolve it. Moving on. Here we are proposing the removal of a double penalty, essentially, where a single misdisclosure can result in two penalties. And here's an interesting one, because if you move on to the next slide, we had a commentator suggest that we should retain the double penalty to cater for certain edge cases. Now, we sat down and tried to think what they might be, and we couldn't think of anything. So we, in the public workshop, we asked that commentator if they could give us a specific example of what they were concerned about, and they haven't come back to us with a specific example. So here's the rare case where us not accepting it is, in fact, a tax favorable measure. Moving on, we come into the customs and excise space. here we've had a number of name changes in what is now the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition. And we are trying to clean up the references in the Act. We were going to do that in the Amendment Act this year. The taxpayer or commentator in this context pointed out that that means you'd have to read the two acts in combination going into the future. So we've accepted that and we're putting the interpretation clause in the Customs and Excise Act itself. So it's all in one place. For accreditation, we deleted some references to particular concessions that are reserved for clients that are accredited. The question was there, should we not also open up this particular item for further use by people even who are not accredited? Here we did not accept it because we felt the deferral of that was something where we would need to have greater understanding and acceptance of a client's systems and capacity to handle that particular concession. So we feel that it would be appropriate to reserve that for accredited clients. Moving on. There was a suggestion that we increase the thresholds below which, if there was an error, SARS would be empowered not to insist on the collection of duty, and something similar on refunds. The commentator here pointed out that there is a linkage into the VAT system and then suggested that we make a consequential amendment with respect to VAT. Unfortunately, that opens up a set of fairly complex interactions. So although we accept that this is something we should explore, it's not something that's going to be easy to do. So we have proposed removing this particular amendment for this year, and we will consider it again for next year. Moving on. We now go into the Tax Administration Act, and apologies, there should have been an intermediate slide there just to highlight that. So here we were trying to deal with a situation where a taxpayer requests an extension very close to the end of prescription, and how would we handle that? And so if we move on, one of the commentators suggested that we reword the provision. And we looked quite hard at what they had proposed, and unfortunately, it's a little bit too blunt of an instrument. It sort of creates a blanket extension where, in fact, it was meant to be a targeted one. And so we're suggesting that the current wording, in fact, is the more appropriate wording. So we did not accept this proposal. Moving on. All right, so here we had a commentator was saying, well, then how will this all play out in practice? And so we sat down and looked at the legislation again, and we agree that there is perhaps a little bit of room here for some extra clarity. So there are some minor tweaks that are being proposed in the bill that will be tabled. But essentially what we've done here is we've set out the three possible options of what could happen once you've provided the relevant material. And that once SARS has responded in that particular fashion, what your remedy will be if you don't agree. Obviously, in option one, we've taken on what you've given us and we've accepted it. So you're going to be happy with that as a taxpayer. In options two and three, SARS either does not fully accept it or does not accept it at all. And then we've laid out what would happen if that was the case and what your remedy would be to dispute that decision by SARS. Moving on. So here there was a request for criteria around how SARS would exercise its discretion. We're pointing out here that that's extremely difficult to do, but we partially accept it because at the moment it's not clear what or how strong the taxpayer's reasons need to be for why they're late. And so we've made it clear here now that it would be a reasonable ground that would be acceptable to SARS. And that has a long line of history in case law and elsewhere, so that should be readily understandable. Moving on. All right, here we had a suggestion that SARS's powers to issue an estimated assessment before prescription should be limited, with at least the ability to request information. And our response here is that we don't accept this because if we've gotten to this stage, SARS has already asked you on multiple occasions for the information, and then the estimated assessment will be raised, and then you still have an opportunity to come forward and provide the material that is required. And then even if that period is too short, you have an opportunity for an extension. So if you put that all together, we think that more than adequately covers the taxpayer's needs. There's a question as to how we would let you know that we don't accept what you've provided, and we've made it clear that we'll be sending you a letter to let you know that is the case and why, what the grounds are for SARS not accepting. Then we have the next two comments, which are the last two comments, turn around the extension of prescription. They're not the last. The last two comments in respect of the Tax Administration Act. They turn around the way prescription works. The first commentator thought that this gave an open-ended extension for prescription. We correct that misapprehension here by pointing out that it was tied into the extension period of 40 days. So that was not the case. But the next commentator, in fact, raised a problem with that formulation, which was that although it was extended for the 40 days, what happened if, you know, SARS only got to look at it on day 41? Would that not create a problem because SARS would then be looking at it after prescription? And so if you look at the next comment, you'll see that that is a comment we've accepted because SARS should have an opportunity to then to actually react and change the assessment to take account of the taxpayer's information that's been provided. So we are reformulating or proposing reformulation of that particular prescription aspect to align with the next commentator's proposal. So if we just move on to the next slide, please. And there you will see it. In fact, we're accepting this commentator's proposal because we think that closes the loop and ensures not only does the taxpayer have an opportunity to give us the information in these cases where prescription, where the date for providing the information or the extension goes past when prescription would normally operate, but SARS has an opportunity then to actually look at that information and make the change as required to give effect to the taxpayer's request to change the assessment, which we think closes the loop nicely, and we thank the commentator for that suggestion. Moving on to the Disaster Management Tax Relief Administration Bill aspect, our Act aspect. Here, members will be aware, we've proposed the extension of the pay-as-you-earn relief that was granted last year for 4 months this year. So let's move through these first two slides because I think that's the essence of what was proposed. And then there was a suggestion that we should extend the definition of a qualifying taxpayer to cover public benefit organizations, both for pay-as-you-earn and the ETI purposes. Now, we haven't accepted that. That was a proposal that was made last year as well, and it wasn't accepted last year because a gross income is a very poor measure for public benefit organization size and activities. And so what we suggest here is that a PBO that finds itself in that space should approach SARS directly to seek relief that can then be appropriately calibrated for their circumstances. We were somewhat puzzled by the suggestion that this would also need to be done for the ETI because the concept of a qualifying taxpayer is not used in the ETI provision, so we didn't see the relevance there. And then that's it from my side. Thank you, Chair.
So, Chair, I think we are done on our side. Chair, can I just say I might just get called by my deputy minister for a cabinet committee meeting, so I may have to just leave for a short while. But Yanga will be in charge. But I'm still here until I'm actually called. So just want to alert you to that. So over to you, Chair.
Okay, National Treasury Team and SARS, we are having challenges here with members who can't be able to connect because of load shedding. The sooner the load shedding is resolved, the better. It's disrupting business, it's disrupting Parliament. So it's quite very bad. As you can see, there were members who were in the platform before, but they were kicked out as a result of load shedding wherever they are. Noxie, Honorable Abraham, are you still there?
I'm still here, Chair, but I'm also kicked in and out by the load shedding, but I'm still here.
Can you share the next item where participants will be making inputs just for 5 minutes each?
Chair? Is it where we are now? Are we there now already?
Yes, we are on item 3. Comments from participants.
So okay, 5 minutes
each. Then you start with the South African Transformation Alliance until Tech Consult, which is the last. There are almost 14 participants in the platform.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay. Thanks, Chair. Ellen, can we get the first participant the 5 minutes for presentation? Just introduce yourself and then you go for your 5 minutes. Over to you.
Hello, Mr. Abraham. Before they say anything, I've circulated the agenda to all the participants so they are aware of what order they are in. And I'm sure that all of them are here.
Okay. So they'll just come in that order. Thank you so much. The first participant, can you please come in and make your presentation? 5 minutes. Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you so much. I'm Mr. Ntando Shetrex BC, the chairman of Tobacco Transformation Alliance. I want just to be specific, Chair, and straight to the point. I want to let the Chair know that due to the lockdown that took 5 months without NSL of tobacco products, it has hit hard in such a way that this season, 2021 to 2022, a bulk of our emerging farmers, the number to be precise is 22, that they've been kicked out of business. It has been my wish all along to see to it that people get something to look after themselves. It is unfortunate that now 22 of our emerging farmers out of business due to the massive illicit that have taken toll in the industry. And it must be known that of the 22 emerging farmers, 18 are women. And some of them, they are widows. If this issue of illicit is not taken so seriously as it deserved, how many of these people now are going to queue for grants? From livelihood to grants, it is unfortunate. Maybe the SARS commissioner, as well as the minister of police, will say to it that the illicit is killing people's livelihood. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Simbisi. Next presenter, please.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry for the delay. My name is Johnny Moloto from British American Tobacco South Africa. I just wanted to just comment on the first few points that Paul from Treasury made in regards to the purpose of excise and why it's being increased, as well as around the policy issues relating to excise. We all agree and understand what the intention behind excise is, you know, to reduce consumption of tobacco products. However, our key contention here is that If we look at what Treasury has projected for this current financial year, they projected a consumption or tax on about 15 billion sticks of a market of 35 billion sticks, which leaves a huge gap of untaxed or duty not paid tobacco products, which means that they are only taxing just slightly over 40% of the market, which from a fairness and a creating an equal playing field for the market, that means it's not only not addressing the health problems that they are supposed to address, but it means that there is still a huge gap of about 20 billion that's not being collected. That actually is then passed on to us as the legal market. The second point is around the point that he made that we also should take the blame for not passing on the excise to the consumer in order to keep the products cheap, which is actually not quite true, because in this current financial year, the excise was 8%, but if you tag on back onto that, we passed over 9% of excise to the consumer this year, whereas the illicit players at the bottom of the market reduced prices by 9%, which means that the price differential is getting bigger and bigger between the legal and illicit players. So that is a huge concern to us, which leads me to the next point, where Treasury says that actually, government is capable of concurrently implementing excise policy while also enforcing. Actually, no. Because if we go by what the SARS commissioner told Parliament yesterday, that they are actually fighting a losing battle in terms of dealing with illicit, it simply means that as matters stand, the illicit problem is not effectively dealt with, and SARS is still merely scratching the surface on this one. So we do request that in doing excise increases, all this should be taken into consideration, because the illicit players do not play according to the rules. And our proposal in this regard, we know SARS issued rules around installing CCTV cameras that's supposed to come online next year. We would recommend that these are brought on board urgently as another urgent measure that could actually assist in controlling illicit volume falling into the market. And the final one is around the 28 rand policy. We take note of that, that it will be done as part of the policy review next year. If only Treasury can just give us a sense as to when we can expect this policy review to begin. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Can we have the next presenter?
Thank you, ma'am. Good morning, Chair. Can you hear me clearly? François van der Merwe speaking.
Loud and clear.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you very much. Good morning, Chair and Committee. Chair, I tried to speak in August, you will remember, and you said to me I'll get my chance today. So thank you for that, Chair, with all best wishes to the committee. I'll speak on behalf of tobacco processors. That is the only tobacco processor in the country which contracts 100% of the flue cured tobacco farmers in South Africa. It's processors that leaf, and it sells more than 90% of its leaf to British American Tobacco, but also to some other buyers. Chair, and that's the value chain. So the tobacco brings the whole value chain to South Africa, with value adding, with high quality products. Chair, just to explain to the committee very briefly, as my two colleagues already mentioned, South African cigarette market is a big market. It's well over 33 billion sticks. Bonnie mentioned 35 billion sticks. So it's a significant market. Chair, what happened during the ban last year, the five-month ban, is that the legal industry complied with the ban. So the legal brands were behind bars. The illicit players took full advantage and they took over the market. So during that time, they had an opportunity with very little enforcement to take over the market. That's basically what happened, and that's a good description. So, Chair, we all hope that after the ban was lifted that we will bounce back as the legal industry. But we are, to our own surprise, not bouncing back. And the reason is very simple, Chair. The ban gave the illicit players an opportunity to take over the market and to entrench themselves. And during that time, they also exploited the consumers by very high prices. We all know that. And then after the ban was lifted, because they don't pay taxes, they just dropped their prices and nobody could compete with that. So that's the nuts and bolts of this, Chair. So we sit with a 33, 35 billion stick market, with which over 60% is illicit, and they have been entrenched, and they are just making a killing. So we as the legal value chain, Chair, farmers, processors and manufacturers, they are down to retailers, are competing in less than 40% of the market. We have to make a living in less than 40% of the market. And SARS and Treasury is taxing and collecting taxes only from less than 40% of the market. So we will not address consumption, as is the intention of excise, and we fully agree with that. But you will not address consumption, you will not reduce consumption as long as the market is flooded, or more than 60% of the market is flooded with cheap, unregulated, rubbish products. Okay? Because of this, we have to think differently. We cannot think business as usual when it comes to excise policy. We can also not think business as usual when it comes to enforcement. And as the Commissioner and the Chief of Customs yesterday told your committee chair, if the media articles are correct, is that they're fighting a losing battle, they're only scratching the surface. But Chair, we are positive. We think this thing can be turned around with huge benefits to SARS and Treasury, with more income, number one. And number two, if the playing field is more level, all products are more expensive and tax paid, then consumption will decline. So only then will you reduce the consumption, which will achieve the health objective, and National Treasury, SARS, will have much more income to spend in South Africa. And so the picture is illicit is entrenched. We are dying. I'm telling you, we are dying. Shadrach mentioned that farmers have already left the industry. Chair, you tell me which industry can survive if it has only 40% of the market, and it cannot compete with an illicit market where they flood the market, they don't pay taxes, unregulated products flooding the market. Okay, I don't want to predict this, but you know, what will the committee or Treasury or SARS say to the legal value chain if we come and stand in front of Parliament and we ask you, as Shadrach said, where will our livelihoods come from because we've lost our livelihoods? Chair, this year we've spared no effort to do market research, market analysis. We've built proposals for SARS. We have tried to point them in the right directions. We have mentioned and named the manufacturers, the brands, the prices who are dealing in the illicit market. And this is all known, Chair. And contrary to popular belief, smuggling from outside is a big problem. But the biggest problem is local manufacturing, I believe. This was said yesterday as well to committee, which makes the solution much easier. And Chair, to make it worse, these players, the biggest players, sit 50 kilometers from SARS. They know who they are, they know their brands, and we've made proposals for SARS to tackle them. And I believe that the Commissioner said yesterday track and trace is not the solution, and he's correct. It is a longer-term solution.
Round off, Mr. Van der Merwe, please round off. Your time is up.
I'm rounding off. We support the comments made, but the minimum price is key. The CCTV cameras is key. The material audit is key. We've made all those proposals to SARS, and we asked Treasury to please hold on excise increases, because the only beneficiaries will be the illicit players. They will just make more money. And next year, I will tell you again that the legal industry is now almost extinct. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much. The next presenter, please. And please stick to your 5 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. It's Nitesh Ramji here from Philip Morris, South Africa. We've noted the presentation and the comments by National Treasury on the excise for heated tobacco products, and we look forward to engaging further with them on this topic. And we would also like to ask for some more information on the timing and the process related to the proposed review of excise tax policy for tobacco products. In the meantime, we will continue to build towards what we call a smoke-free future, where smokers who are not able to quit, we will encourage them to switch to scientifically proven, less harmful products, and we will continue to provide examples and precedents from other parts of the world where regulatory authorities have gone through the evidence, gone through the science. Most notably in the U.S., where the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, has classified our heated tobacco product as a modified risk tobacco product, and also the emerging peer-reviewed science and journal articles that continue to increase. So we look forward to the opportunity to engage more on this topic and to illustrate how tax policy can help smokers switch to better alternatives. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you so much, and thanks for saving us some time. Thank you. Next presenter.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Kurt Moore. I'm the CEO of Salba, representing manufacturers and distributors of alcoholic beverages. We wanted to also thank the Chair for the opportunity and for the feedback from Treasury on our comments into the rates bill. We are naturally disappointed with the feedback, and while we note the reasons, what was missing from the feedback is the central point that we tried to raise around policy certainty. The department is currently, and they've admitted so, today again, operating outside its policy framework, which we would assume is the only tool that this honourable committee has to hold the department to account. The amendments that were defended today de facto amounts to an abandonment of its own policy. And while there is a plan to introduce a policy review process, these changes that are happening right now, as I said, amounts to a de facto abandonment of the policy. In 2014, we participated in a policy review process, which was very comprehensive. Treasury tabled a position paper supported by research, and industry was afforded an opportunity to respond fully, also with some supporting research. During that review process, we had an opportunity to evaluate the unintended consequences more fully, such as illicit trade. And like the previous speaker said, we don't believe that the increases in excise taxes will actually achieve the objectives, which is to address consumption if all of this goes, if that consumption goes into the illicit market. And as we go into another round of excise adjustments, we'd like to have more policy certainty. The previous minister spoke of policy certainty for avocado farmers. Why are wine farmers excluded from this policy certainty? The notion of having to increase without an understanding of where government is heading, it makes it very difficult for investment into our sector. So we would like to, we look forward to the engagement on the excise policy. And like the previous speaker, Mr. van der Merwe said, let's hold off on these excessive adjustments until we have a full understanding of the implications and start operating within the policy environment which has been set by government. With that, thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Kat. That was also very costly time-wise. Next presenter.
Thank you, Chair. It's the Beer Association of South Africa. I'm Patricia Pillay. I'm the CEO. I'm joined by my colleague today, Fatani from the SAB team, and we'll be co-presenting. Fatani, if you can just outline in our quick time, please, and hand over to you.
Thanks, Patricia. Thank you, Chair. Like our previous presenters, we'd like to emphasize on the comments from that Treasury made. In particular, we'd like to highlight that the out-of-policy adjustments in terms of excise continues to be a great concern for the Beer Association. While there have been different iterations of the current excise policy framework in 2002 and 2014, there has been no sentiment that the policy framework is set out to be an implementation mechanism that not only sets out the rules, but also gives us a guide as to what type of certainty and transparency around the nature and the ways in which the implementation of the framework is to take place. We also would like to highlight that the presidency itself has set out in the release of the National Policy Development Framework at the end of 2020 that there are principles around public policy making and practices in South Africa that require clarity, including the implementation of public policy principles.
Excuse me, ma'am. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Could you kindly make sure that your video is on? That includes all the presenters after you, because their presentations are flighted. Thank you so much.
No problem. So in the sense, I would like to highlight that the predictability principle in the framework highlighted by the presidency is key. I will quote exactly what it says. It says that regulation should be predictable in order to give stability and certainty to the regulated. And this reduces the uncertainty and helps to ensure fairness in the implementation of the public policy. And we haven't seen that with excise since its implementation in 2002. We also would like to highlight that the National Treasury, whilst reviewing the current excise policy, we are concerned, Chair, that in the level in which the policy has been engaged or implemented at an out of policy since 2002, we are worried that the sentiment is that it will be just a set of guidelines that will be improved, but there are no implementation mechanisms that will create certainty and transparency around the contents and the direction of the policy. Also, Chair, I'd like to attend to the point that Treasury raised around the industry not providing complete pass-through of excise into prices. Chair, as it has been highlighted by the tobacco industry, consumers remain price sensitive, and we are cognizant of the fact that households do not have high disposable incomes, and that is the macroeconomic environment in which businesses must work with. So when Treasury says that there is no complete pass-through on price, we know that this does not happen, but it is only because legal alcohol is essentially competing with illicit alcohol because excise is being implemented outside of the policy framework, which is above inflation. And we'd like to say that the fact that this continues means that customers who are price sensitive are actually substituting away from legal alcohol to illicit alcohol. Lastly, Chair, I'd like to highlight that there are only 3 months left in the current budget cycle, and we have not as of yet received any clear transparency around the policy review process. We are worried, Chair, that we are approaching the budget, and tomorrow we'll hear about the medium term, but we have no sentiment around this policy review process, and as key direct stakeholders, that we have no say as to, in good time, as to what exactly the nature and the contents of this policy review will take place. Thanks. I hand back over to our Chair of the Beer Association, Patricia.
So thank you, Chair, and thank you to the team for this opportunity. I think that my colleague at Salba spoke about the research that we did as a collective, as an industry, and the illicit industry in alcohol as overall has grown by 43%. The point that my colleague Fatsani was making in terms of the increase and passing through to the consumer is a very important one, because we all did read during the lockdown, which we cannot ignore or forget, where people were brewing their own home brews, which is something that we don't have a problem with. But the problem is when people who don't know how to home brew properly buy out all the pineapples in the store and all the yeast so people cannot bake, but they're trying to brew and then they actually lose their lives. And this is where things start getting out of hand, because we know that public health is absolutely critical. And this is what we want to avoid, is to avoid people going into an illicit market, doing things that are dangerous. We have young children that are going and drinking cough mixture and mixing it with other ingredients. So the issue that we have is more than just putting a tax on something. It's about changing behavior. And that is something that we're focusing on as an industry. So I don't think that, and our submission respectfully, is that just putting in an increase that's above inflation is not going to be the stamp. In conclusion, I'd just like to reiterate the point we made in our submission to please consider our smaller brewers, our craft brewers, the younger supply chain that we're looking at, the entrepreneurs, the job creation that we are looking at in this industry. They have not recovered and they are not recovering. And what is worse, and I will keep on emphasizing, we do not receive relief as an industry, as the beer industry or the alcohol industry as a collective. We are exempted from any relief that government gives out. It is something that we've raised on different other platforms, and I want to reiterate, this will be a relief for us, and we really do plead that you hear our plea and at least consider our motivation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, ma'am. AgriSA. Can we get the next presenter, please?
Thank you very much, Chair, and to the Honourable Chairman and Honourable Members of the Portfolio Committee, to the officials of National Treasury and all colleagues in the industry. Good morning and thank you for the opportunity to address you. My name is John Purchase. I'm the CEO of AgBiz. And I just want to address the one matter that we did raise, and I appreciate that National Treasury have looked at this thoroughly and have made certain proposals, adopted certain or accepted certain proposals and partially accepted others. From our perspective, we welcome that there's at least a delay in because of the problems many businesses are facing, given the COVID pandemic, given the insurrection in KZN and Gauteng and various other supply chain problems. So that there's a bit of a standoff or a bit of a delay in the implementation. The one issue that we did raise was around the cyclical nature of agriculture and agribusiness, and it is addressed, and there's a partial relief, if I can call it that, with a de minimis threshold of 1 million that's been included to the 80% that can be carried forward. We're not sure how that 1 million was arrived at. It sounds a bit arbitrary. Obviously, we would like to engage on that and to have that higher, perhaps even 10 million, if possible, because 1 million will be very few businesses that will find much relief from that. So that is one issue, but we do acknowledge the partial acceptance of our proposal to relook that. I think that's all from our side. Obviously, some of our other members have raised some substantive issues which we think need to be considered around the illicit trade in alcohol and tobacco, etc. Thank you very much, Chair.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks also for saving us time. The next presenter.
Ms. Abraham, Sean Miller indicated that he's got a 11 o'clock meeting, so he's left the platform. So we can move on to BASA, Banking Association.
Is that the case with the 3.8 item as well?
3.8 just spoke AgBiz. AgriSA doesn't seem like anybody is representing them here today.
Oh, okay. Then let's go to 3.10 Banking Association. Thank you so much, Alan.
Thank you. I am Jeanette Marie. I'm from BASA. Dion Kutsia will also be weighing in. We'll merely be addressing the reuse of collateral. So first of all, thanks to National Treasury for setting up a follow-up workshop, where we had a constructive discussion of their concerns and our concerns. And then thanks for the undertaking to remove the retrospectivity and the contractual requirements. That does go some way towards providing some form of certainty for the industry at large. Given National Treasury's confirmation that what was intended with the draft legislation was merely to clarify the existing legislation, we are concerned with the earlier comments that they still propose limiting the collateral reuse and merely carving out some very limited bank and Direct 28 situations. And I think what we need to be cognizant of is the fact that there is a very large industry use of collateral arrangements dispensation out there, which would be outside of these carved out situations. And if we end up with limitations on that, we could have really far-reaching impacts on market liquidity in general and impacts on various industry areas actually doing business locally and globally. As with all things legislation, the devil is in the detail. And until we see how the revised final bill actually pans out and what the wording looks like, we won't know what the impact is. But we do caution that a limitation on legitimate collateral reuse will really have very far-reaching consequences. I would like to just hand over to Leon Christia now.
Thank you, Jeanette. Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity. Just want to echo what Jeanette has stated, that in the response document, we value the relaxation on the date and the contractual requirements. However, we quite concerned about the slide 34, where National Treasury mentioned the clarification, but it looks like further restrictions on the securities lending industry. So though we welcome the relaxation or the specific carve-outs for banks there, we need to caution, as Jeanette has pointed out, on the major impact this could have on the entire securities lending industry. And we would like to engage National Treasury once the legislation is out, just to make sure that there's not unintended consequences. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Can we get the next presenter, please?
Good day. This is Beatrix Host from South African Institute of Taxation. I'm hoping you can see me. I'm starting my video on my side. There we go. Thank you so much, Chair, for the opportunity. We've listened to National Treasury and SARS presenting, and thank you so much for the continued engagement on all the matters raised. We will go through the presentation and the draft legislation as soon as it's released tomorrow, and then engage you further with the Annex C process. It would be helpful to know just from an Annex C point of view when the process will start and when comment should go through this year. One realizes that it's not a normal year. So from that perspective, one does appreciate that it might be a truncated process. On further matters, I think I want to echo what Leon was saying. To the extent that there's any additional engagement that needs to happen, we will go through the legislation and then contact our colleagues and have further engagement on that front. Thank you so much.
Okay. Next, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. And thank you, good morning, honorable members and members of the public. Thank you for this opportunity once again. It's quite, we've had a few interesting changes, and we want to thank National Treasury and SARS for their comprehensive feedback. As with the other commentators, we look forward to reading the details to see exactly where we are heading. But based on the presentation, most of our issues addressed in Parliament specifically have been addressed. But again, a little bit more clarity would be appreciated on the, it seems to be the extension of the reduction in the corporate tax rate to 27%, linked to the increase or the assessed loss amendments and the interest limitation amendments, exactly when that is going to take place, because we do have a few issues still on that, and we'll wait for further legislation on that. But just clarity about, you know, when we can expect that to come through. I think the two important points that I want to raise here was actually three, is first of all that we note that a lot of the changes have now been amended to no longer be retrospective, which we really do appreciate. It is just concerning that that keeps happening, that we have these retrospective data where we have to come back and then change them. So we do note some of the concerns where there is abuse, et cetera. But in a lot of these cases, the abuse that they were talking about, we weren't sure what it was. And I think that's, again, where we request SARS National Treasury to provide a little bit more clarity on what the abuse is. And that leads me to the second point, which is the specific changes to the abuse. We saw a lot of the provisions coming through that related to abuse, but wasn't related to the particular change as it was. So rather focusing on the abuse and leaving the general provisions as it is our request at this stage. With regard to the issues that weren't included in the bill, and we raised this for a number of years, and Beatrice mentioned the Annexure C process, which we'd also appreciate clarity on exactly when that will take place. But there are a few things that weren't included in the bill, and we do appreciate National Treasury doing their workshops, taking some of those into consideration and including them in the discussions there and changing some of those things. But there's things that weren't included in the bill include, for instance, the Home Office relief that we did request. It was discussed at the workshop. We realized that. But again, a lot of the changes that might be coming through in this regard will be too late for a lot of the individuals that were sitting or had to work from home and incur a whole lot of additional costs that weren't reimbursed by a lot of the employers. Also things like fringe benefits, relief for those where employers were trying to help their employees during the unrest. Again, no exemption was included for that. As well as for our essential workers, which we again did put in previously in the disaster management relief bills, but nothing seems to have come through. And that leads me to my last point, and that is the timing of this particular engagement. We realized it's been a very different year. However, it does, you know, we need to question, you know, having this just before the bills are released. What if there were major implications? And to be honest, in this year, looking at some of the issues that we discussed during the workshop, there were really important issues, and we weren't sure which way National Treasury was going to go. So if we had issues, you know, if we just look at the retirement reform, if that was not withdrawn at this stage, what would have been the process? So it is concerning. Luckily, I think National Treasury has agreed to most of our concerns, but I hope it doesn't happen again. Because, yeah, it is concerning, you know, what would have the process have been if substantive changes had to be made by Parliament? But other than that, I really do want to thank National Treasury and SARS for the workshops. It was really engaging, and we did, I think, thrash a lot of this out. It would be nice if we could have a lot of these discussions before the legislation comes in place so we don't sit with this particular problem. But all in all, the engagement, we appreciate the ability to provide examples to clarify some of our comments. It does help in both of us understanding where we're going, where National Treasury is going with the legislation, what our practical viewpoints are. So we really do appreciate that. But yeah, thank you for the opportunity, and we look forward to reading the details.
Thank you so much. The next one should be PwC.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the members for the opportunity to provide some initial comments and feedback on in terms of Treasury's responses. I'm Carl Mandy. I'm the tax policy leader for PwC. There's just a few issues I want to touch on in response to Treasury's response document in their presentation. The first is in relation to the proposed exit tax for retirement funds, which Treasury has decided to withdraw from this year's legislation. We certainly welcome that and believe that is the prudent approach and applaud Treasury for doing so. The thing I would like to highlight, however, is while Treasury has indicated that they will revisit this insofar as legislation is concerned in the next legislative cycle, what I would emphasise and implore on Treasury is that it's unlikely that they're going to be able to deal with this through domestic legislation. We previously acknowledged the concern, and the concern that Treasury has is valid. But in our view, the only way to address this is through renegotiation of the treaty. So we would strongly suggest that the sooner the Treasury initiate that process of renegotiating the treaties in question, the sooner they'll be able to address the issue. And that is a long and drawn-out process to do so, but that is probably the only way in which they're going to be able to successfully remedy the situation in the long run. The second issue that I want to touch on is the interest limitation deductions, or the limitation on interest deduction, interest deductions. The postponement of that, I think, generally the postponement is welcomed in circumstances. The There are a number of issues in that legislation, in the draft legislation, which will still be in this year's bills, that Treasury did not provide any responses to. It remains to be seen what those look like, but we'll address that as necessary as part of the next receipt process. Similarly, with regards to the assessed loss limitations and the postponement thereof, again, we would welcome that in the current environment. But once again, there are also significant issues that were raised as part of the discussions and which will be in this year's legislation and which were not addressed by Treasury as part of their responses, which again, we will need to potentially address once we see the detail in the bill. One issue insofar as assessed losses that I do want to touch on, in which Treasury did respond to, is the question around the de minimis, where they have proposed this 1 million rand de minimis rule insofar as the use of assessed losses is concerned. AGBIS did touch on it a little earlier as well, but I'll just add a little bit of flavour to that. We are certainly agreeing that de minimis rule is too low in the circumstances. Treasury did indicate that certainly when you look at our limitation rule in isolation, it is relatively generous, and that may be true, but the danger comes to that is when you simply look at that rule in isolation and do not take into account assessed loss regimes as a whole. The other countries in question, which Treasury alluded to, have two significant differences insofar as their assessed loss regimes are concerned, and that is that they allow the carry back of our losses, i.e. what does that mean? Well, it means that not only do those countries allow taxpayers to carry forward assessed losses to subsequent years, but they allow them to actually be carried back and used against prior years' taxable profits. So that's a significant, the more generous regime that South Africa has. And to add to that, those countries also allow group tax or have group tax systems, which allows then assessed losses generated in one company within a group to be offset against profits in another company within the same group. Again, resulting in a far more generous regime. So I do think that 1 million rand de minimis needs to be re-looked at. It's only going to provide relief to the smallest companies in question. The final item that I want to just touch on is Treasury's response insofar as the proposals around contributory tax capital are concerned. While we note the proposal and we will certainly look at the detail in the legislation, the suggestion that general repurchases insofar as listed shares are concerned will be excluded from the rule is just completely nonsensical on the face of it. From a purely technical perspective, such repurchases, as we said already, don't constitute dividends in terms of the definition. So it just makes no sense to us on the face of it as to how that will provide any relief whatsoever, while the real issue at hand seemingly has not been addressed. But again, the devil will be in the detail insofar as the bill is concerned, and we will have a look at that. Which then just brings into focus, if you like, the comment that Saka made around the whole process and the fact that we are today getting the response document that the bills will be tabled tomorrow, and the process in terms of getting any further the changes made to those bills that may be required is going to be extremely difficult in the circumstances. So the situation is by no means ideal, and I would emphasise again what Saka asked for, and that is that we don't see a repeat of the situation in future. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Now can we have the last presenter? It is the last presenter, hey, Alan? Tax Consult.
Yes, that's the last presenter. After that, members will then ask clarity seeking questions from National Treasury and SARS, and that should be it for today.
Thank you. Tax consult.
John, you are on mute.
My apologies. Our primary issue was regarding the tax on retirement interests, which has been withdrawn. I think our only comment would be to echo what PwC said in that where the proposal is revisited, our view is that it would have to be dealt with on an international tax or treaty level. But other than that, we welcome and appreciate the withdrawal. No, any other comments on any items of the response document? Thanks.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for saving us time. We appreciate the fact that the various organizations have been here to present and ensure public participation. We will now ask members to seek questions of clarity, maybe to National Treasury and SARS, if not to the presenters. Honorable members, Can we see hands? Who is Dion's phone? Okay, I'll start with you, Mabiletsa.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I think for me, I'll just have a comment briefly, quickly, because I'm away before I'm kicked out. You know, as they were presenting, Chair, I could hear and feel that this was a difficult year. I think from 2020 for the whole economy. And the illicit trade in cigarette is continuing. And we are just, appealing to SARS so that they must at least do something. I know they are doing something, but continue, because then it is bringing more and more burden, you know, to the taxpayers. And I'm grateful also to hear that there are plans, because really, when you listen, you can see that everybody really, they need something for the burden that they're having to be.
Mamela, you can't come in. Okay.
Chairperson.
Okay, sorry, go ahead, Mabiletsa.
Okay, yeah. I was just saying, you know, this was a difficult year for everybody, and I'm just appealing to SARS so that they must just continue to do something with the illicit trade. And perhaps, you know, once and for all, they must also pay, because they are there selling. Why can't they pay tax as well, you know? And also, I'm happy just to hear that there is something that is going to be done, just to ease the burden for everybody and the burden of the tax that they are having. It is my comment. And thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Mabiletsa. I'm sorry for the disturbance. Okay, it's Honorable George. Honorable George, can you take the floor, please?
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm on my phone, as you know, due to connectivity issues as a result of the power failures. Thanks very much. Firstly, I'd like to welcome also the withdrawal of the proposed punitive pension tax. It was most likely unconstitutional anyway, and it would have been challenged. So I think that's a good thing that is off the table. And then on the taxpayer extensions, the commissioner has said regularly, and he said the same yesterday, that SARS assumes that taxpayers do want to comply. So if a taxpayer has got a reasonable request for an extension, I do think that there should be some kind of accommodation. I do note that the SARS has rejected the inputs from participants on that. But I do think there needs to be a reasonable balance, because obviously SARS has a lot more power than your average taxpayer. But anyway, that is my comment on that. And then finally, I just want to ask a question on the tax deductions for public benefit organizations. How do you consider, or have you considered, the source of the donations to these PBOs? Now, for example, you have a PBO, it receives donations, and it takes those donations and then funds political parties and independent candidates to run for office. In that way, it bypasses the Political Party Funding Act because it's not a political party, but its donors then may well claim tax deductions for their donations to the PBO. So I'm just wondering whether SARS has thought about that and how they would prevent that from happening, because that clearly would be something that nobody would want to happen. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you so much, Honorable George. There being no more hands from the members, can we get some responses, please? Can we see the hands from National Treasury and SARS?
Okay, Chair. I think let me just.
Okay, Momo.
Chair, so I'll just start off. I think, Chair. You know, we always have the issue with both the tobacco and the alcohol industry coming to lobby. And I think some of the arguments that they put up, we would seriously challenge. Firstly, it's a right of the state to impose higher excise duties. Whatever guidebook we have, the minister does have that power. And honestly, the industry needs to do far more to look at the impact of their products on the health of the nation. And I think the lockdown has really revealed to what extent, if you look at the alcohol industry, has an immediate effect in trauma units and so on. So it's a bit disingenuous to suggest, I think, that the impact of these taxes or measures are not working. Yes, they're not working as well as they should. And even on the vaping industry, we've announced our intention to also, and we will be publishing our paper, it's been finalized, but moving people away from tobacco to vaping products is also not the way to go. Yes, it's a step down for those who are hooked on tobacco, but it's also a step for the younger generation to get from vaping and e-cigarettes into smoking. And doesn't matter if it's FDA approved. I think that we need to look at certain behaviors that are taking place. So I just wanted to make those points. I think that the tax system plays a critical role. And yes, it may not be working as effectively as we like. And yes, there is the issue of the illicit industry where more needs to be done. And we must do more. And certainly those are the engagements we have with the authorities imposing higher taxes. I think that there may be some links to that, but we do need to focus on that. I'll let some of our team come and comment on the specifics, but I just thought, I want to deal with what I see as very organized lobbying from the two industries. There's been many discussions, even at NATLAC, Chair, and I do think that the industry really needs to do more. And they're not doing enough. And it is having a serious impact on the health of our nation and on our hospitals and so on. So we are pretty strong when we've announced these measures. Yes, there are negative effects, but that's not like illicit trade, but that's still not a reason not to proceed with the measures that we have. Umpo, I don't know if you want to add on those points. Since you're dealing with
Okay, thank you, Momo. Let's take
and Yanga and so on. And Chair, sorry, I do have to leave now. So if you don't mind, I'm going to excuse myself. I'll just stay for a few more minutes, and I'll try and come back if the meeting is still on. Sorry, Yanga.
Okay, thank you so much,
Chris is coming in.
Chris is coming in, and then after Chris, it's Tom, Franz Tom, and then Yanga will close it for us. Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you, Chair. Morning, honourable members. Afternoon. Morning, still honourable members. Yes, just on the excise duties, I mean, there are quite a few calls on the review. So, yeah, we are working on the review. We'll follow a similar process as last time where we publish our thoughts and then we can engage with industry to look at all the research and all the impact in terms of how we take that review forward. I mean, there is this point about, you know, complaining about the policy, you know, being outside of the guidelines and what about uncertainty. You know, the current structure of the system is that, you know, if there isn't this path through, then suddenly those percentages go up. So in effect, the industry can influence where you are in terms of that policy guideline, which obviously isn't optimal. So we are looking at it and we will try to provide more details on that. There's lots of points that we'll note, for example, on de minimis, on the exit tax, on the clarity on the CIT rate, which we will look at. I think the one thing I really wanted to comment on was in the comments on from Dr. Muller on the employment tax incentive. We don't have a section of that in the response document, mostly because it doesn't apply directly to any of the amendments in the legislation. It's sort of a more general comment. He is trying to say, and I think perhaps we should talk to him separately, but he is trying to say that, you know, we misled the public and the parliament in terms of the employment tax incentive. You know, we would quite strongly disagree with that. All the research is available and it is out. The pilot project was slightly different to the national one that was rolled out, but it would have to be. It's difficult to do a national pilot. And a lot of the research after that, it has been mixed. So there has been some research showing that there hasn't been a good impact on employment and some research showing that there has been a good impact on employment, and we keep looking at that. I think it's unique in terms of all tax incentives in that there are so many papers being written on this employment tax incentive. I think there's 6 or 7 so far. And we also weren't trying to hide anything with the previous extension to 10 years. It went to NEDLAC. Treasury proposed 5 years. NEDLAC had independent research, which had nothing to do with us. We also put our own research forward, but there was independent research. And it was NEDLAC that proposed to this committee that it should be extended for 10 years rather than 5 years, which we weren't trying to force NEDLAC to do. That was their view. But we can discuss that more, but, you know, we really aren't trying to hide anything in that respect. There were points on Home Office and the fringe benefits relief. Those are really policy measures that we looked at and didn't include in those disaster management reliefs. But the review on the Home Office would continue, and we did say that in the budget that we would look at more info in terms of how do you adjust that policy going forward as part of our general reviews. I'm sure Yanga and France and colleagues can add. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Franz Tomasek.
Thank you. So two questions to my address, I think. The one was around the extensions. And just to be clear, what we're talking about here are the extensions when a taxpayer wishes to request SARS to change an estimated assessment. So what we did there is we partially accepted the taxpayer's comment. What we suggested we would do is we would make it clear that the taxpayer needed to advance reasonable grounds. Now, why would we say that? Now, there are two standards that you will find in the Tax Administration Act. The one is that of reasonable grounds, which is the lowest standard. And then there's a second standard of exceptional circumstances. And so what we were doing here is making it clear that it was, in fact, the lowest standard that applied in this context. And then just on the question on PBOs, the use of PBO funds to support a political party is specifically prohibited by Section 30, subsection 2, subsection H of the Income Tax Act. So a PBO that is doing that is, in fact, in contravention of the Income Tax Act. So, yes, we have thought of it. And I think that's it from my side. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Franz. Yanga?
Oh, thank you, Chair. I'm going to comment on three issues. There's a process issue of 2021, there's a process issue of 2022, and then there are small few issues on collateral. I just want to say up front that when we had our workshops on the 7th, 8th, and 9th of September, during the workshops, there was an argument that, yes, the financial industry has evolved and deviated, and it has developed. Hence, they understand what we are doing. So they admitted by themselves during the workshops. I've written that down because during the workshops, I also quoted the minutes from the meeting that we had during 2014 and 2015 when we first introduced these provisions in the legislation. So we are of the view that, Leon and Jeanette, that we have interacted and we have made changes, and we have made changes based on our interactions. Yes, we have said partially accepted based on the comments. And I want to say that the full response document, these are the slides presentation, the full response document will be available to you, whereby everything will be detailed down more than what is on the slide. With regards to the 2021 process, I would like taxpayers to bear with us the comment from Kyle, the comment from SAICA, and slight comment from SAIT. This was a very difficult year because, first of all, there was a set date for the response document. I think it was 13th October. But the dates were postponed because of the local government elections. So this year is different from other years. So I'd like taxpayers to understand that it is not like every year we do it like this. This year is a different year than other years because this response document was postponed. We could not do it on the 13th of October because Parliament was closed because of the local government elections. So this is the time that we can come to Parliament to do the response document. So it is not like all the years we are doing it like this, no, because this year was a different year. Coming to the 2022 process, we normally do the 2022 process, start the Annexure C 2022, after the minister has tabled the 2021 tax bills, because one would think that once tabled, that process is finalized. So the bills will be tabled tomorrow, meaning that we have to send a request for Annexure C proposals in the coming days after the bills have been tabled tomorrow. And I just want to point out that we normally give taxpayers 30 days to provide comments. So if maybe we issue the media statement on the 15th and say taxpayers are given 30 days to comment, that will be 15th December. The problem is that when will we have the workshops for Annexure C? Because by that time now we are going to Christmas. So there are either two things that we can do, which is to issue out the media statement for request for Annexure C. However, give taxpayers less than 30 days to provide comments for Annexure C, of which some of them will complain, because we normally have our Annexure C workshops before we close for December. This implies that we can have the Annexure C workshop on the second week of December, like 10, 11, 12, or 11, 12, 13, at least before the 15th of December, so that at least we do everything before the close of December so that we are ready for Annexure C in January. So that is what we're going to ask, because there's going to be short time to provide comments for Annexure C because of the timing of this year. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you so much to both National Treasury and SARS for the responses. And maybe let me also thank all the presenters who were able to come and make their presentations to the committee. And maybe let me also borrow a concept that has been used by most of the presenters about the devil being in the detail, and say we probably all have to wait until the minister has presented the bill in Parliament so that we know for sure what is it that is contained
in the bill, and what is it that that we can challenge from the bill. But from where I'm sitting, I think a lot of work has happened before this particular meeting between National Treasury and the stakeholders in terms of the workshops and the interactions that have happened. And I think the department at this stage has to play a very balancing act, because if we listen to the presentations, some agree with one another, but some differ vastly. And therefore, I just want to thank the presenters who have come forward to make known their concerns. And we will meet after the presentation by the minister has been made in Parliament to really find out exactly how they were affected and how they could probably survive under the circumstances. Honourable members, the support staff from the department as well as from Parliament, officials from the department, the leaders in the various organizations. Let me take this opportunity and thank everybody who has been part of this meeting and participated to enrich the discussions here. Alan, can you get any announcement?
No announcements really, except to say that there's lock up tomorrow for members of parliament, E249, the members that are attending, starts at 11. And then on Friday, it's the briefing by the Minister of Finance and his team to the four Finance and Appropriations Committees. That meeting is scheduled for 9 o'clock Friday morning.
Thank you. That takes care of business for today. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.